We start things off like we do each Tuesday by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, what's up, sir?
I am doing what I do, getting by day at a time. That's every cliche out there. I follow them. I embrace them, Colin. That's what I'm all about. It's comfort.
You retain your freshness, though, I feel.
For a while, it'll all collapse. It's going to end ugly, but that's okay. In the meantime, I'll enjoy it while it lasts. So we got a lot of things we want to talk about today, and I want to begin with an upcoming piece you're doing for the Wall Street Journal on the idea that a time without sports can be a good thing. I've certainly felt that way, but I'm curious to hear your rationale for that.
I hope I'm doing it, because actually, as I was waiting to come on, I saw that they were phoning me, and I'm thinking, oh, no.
Oh, dear.
What we're looking for. Yeah, so I just texted them, so who knows what that's about. But the premise of the op-ed that I hope is coming out is that a year, the remainder of 2020 without sports might not be such a bad thing. And I think that I'm in a position to make that argument, because normally if somebody makes that argument, they're going to be one of those people who's just anti-sports, right? Like
right.
Everybody in publishing, they hate sports. They associate it with getting picked on at school and getting scolded and dodgeball in gym class. And whereas I write about sports laws and talk about sports and played sports and all that kind of stuff. But I think what in a remainder of 2020 without sports can do is actually help sports for us. We're bombarded with sports constantly, because even when it's the off season, something, the NFL, it never goes away, and it goes away less so than ever with Twitter and the like. You see what players are up to and they're so-called chirping each other and whatnot. And I think we become obsessed with the notion of victories, wins and losses. And really, I like sports the most when, as I get older, when I'm not as invested really in the team winning. I think if you experience life stuff, that has a perspective. It falls back into the background for you. But it's interesting to me, like when you follow the Red Sox and maybe they're not doing very well, and you see guys trying to hang on for another year, and you see other people trying to push them out of a job. That's lifelike to me. That parallels people's own lives to a different sort of more human degree. And I think that there is something to be said about watching your team and pulling for your team and monitoring that when it's August and there are 12 games out. And I think an absence of sports can remind people that it's not all about just who has the number one seed in the AFC, that there's a lot more going on that's of use for us in our own lives.
I couldn't agree more. And if there's any team, I don't really have a rooting interest in the NFL. I was a Giants fan forever, but I'm pretty worn down to the whole NFL experience these days. But it's the Red Sox that I probably still cling to the most. Although all that hardware, all those championships have taken away the sense of urgency. But I also remember growing up at a time when the Red Sox just weren't that great. Some stretches there in the early 70s and even into the early 80s, where if you were listening to those games or watching those games in September, that's because you just really liked the game of baseball and that team, because there was no hope at a championship or anything like that. And some ways I missed those years of not watching it just to be on the duck boat parade at the end.
In the early 70s, and like, say, 93, they always had a clutch of interesting superstar type players that were at various points of their career. And I think that was interesting. Even like in 1983, when I first started following them, they weren't very good, but you had Yastrzemski at the end. And I think it also speaks to where you might be in your life or what you've gone through in your life. So that's kind of a twin bill for me. I don't have a lot going on in my life right now outside of, I just work. I try to get out of the situation I'm in. And also I've endured a certain number of things and a number of singular things that gives me a perspective I wouldn't have had when I was all gung-ho in 2003 and they're getting knocked out of the ALCS and they're coming back in 2004 and they might actually do this. So it's kind of companionship, and that makes me sound like some old guy in a retirement home or something. But at the same time, I think there is just an ebb and flow. There's a rhythm to a season that dovetails with the ebb and flow, if you're fortunate, of life. And so there's always compelling narratives to be seen. And I don't know how compelling in and of itself the championship drive narrative is. I think it's compelling for meatheads, but in younger people, because I'm old, but I think like when you're 18 or you're 20 or whatnot, but eventually it sort of flakes away and you see these other storylines. Narrative is always all around us in life if we know how to. You can see narrative in a building, the way it's designed, the way it's playing off its environment. There's always narrative around us, and I think this gives us an opportunity to see, better see those narratives in sports.
Well, I hope so. We'll see how it all plays out, because I'm very doubtful the way the major league owners and the players are posturing that we're going to see any baseball this year.
I don't think you want to do it either. And this is not that I'm actually going to pitch. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. But I think you're going to end up with false positive champions. And there are always going to be these disclaimers around the champions. I think the NBA could be the league that's the closest to an actual champion that you would have had otherwise, because it's such a star-driven league. But the NHL is about momentum. It's about rhythm. And people say that the Bruins will be hurt by the stoppage. Well, they're an older team. So do they win the cup because they had this breather, essentially, late in the season? And the NFL, you can't do a season less than 12 games. And if we're already shutting things down until Labor Day, then you're cutting it close. You can't have a 10-game NFL season, and it's not like you can schedule double headers or play every 3 days because of the nature of the sport. So you're going to end up with these champions that no one ever really takes that seriously, an 80-game baseball season. Are you really going to believe in that champion in 12 years' time? I tend to think not.
No, I agree with you there. All right, we're going to shift gears and talk about music. And you sent me some links to some terrific live performances. And, you know, everything's out there, but you have to know where to look for it. And let's start with this great performance by the Yardbirds. This is a terrific one.
Yes. This is a triple LP bootleg, and I read about this. The bootleg is called Last Rave Up in LA, and the title is, bootlegs kind of had cheeky titles, and this was one of the earliest bootlegs, so it's the Jimmy Page version of the band. Jeff Beck is gone, Eric Clapton is long gone, and we've spoken about the sort of Zeppelin Yardbirds divide, and this is when, even though it's just Jimmy Page who's going to go on and form Led Zeppelin, where you have a kind of Zeppelin Yardbirds estuary. You have some overlap. And I remember seeing the set list before I heard this bootleg. Now, the thing is, with some of these bootlegs, you have to get good at listening past the really bad sound quality. These are field recordings, and they were made from recorders and people's jacket pockets or whatever it might have been. So you really have to care, I feel, about the music. It's nothing you'd hear like in a mall. It's not like easy background listening music. But I saw the set list, and I'm seeing the Yardbirds do Hey Jip, which they would have known from The Animals in 1966. So they're in this essence covering The Animals. They're covering The Velvet Underground with I'm Waiting for the Man, which was, again, just very surprising to me. And they're stretching out on these numbers. They're playing 10, 12-minute songs, and they're covering, not even covering, but they're doing their own New York City Blues, which always had this outtake kind of feel from the Jeff Beck version of the band. But they kept it around in their set list. When it was never in the set list, I don't think, when Beck was in the band. So you had these weird things going on, and they were doing so much contrapuntally, harmonically, that you can study this kind of electric, baroque music, and it's not a glimpse of anything you would have had with the rest of what this band was doing at the end of what was the Yardbirds run.
Yesterday was Eric Burdon's 79th birthday, and I have always felt that the Animals get grossly overlooked when people talk about the great bands of the 1960s, and you found a couple of great live performances from the Animals in Paris.
Yes, so one is Trunk Is from 1964. The Animals were a great rhythm and blues combo in 63 and 64. That's when they're doing House of the Rising Sun, Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, is coming along soon after. In 65 and 66, while they're still the original Animals, but Alan Price is gone, they develop this proto-metal edge to them, inside looking out, that I don't think people are aware of how tough this band's sound was. You hear about people like The Who and Hendrix, but the Animals, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, were kind of the American version of what the Animals were doing. Their sound was very rough-edged, and it was this burgeoning form of metal while still doing some of the slowest blues that you would get. The Rolling Stones wouldn't even do gin house blues, from a kind of beat group, really, is what they were. And so you have this recording from Paris in 1966, that's the other sort of half of this bootleg. And they're doing songs like Inside Looking Out, C.C. Rider, which Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels would do as well. In fact, on the Animals single version of the song, they reference Eric Burdon takes a sarcastic swipe at Mitch Ryder near the end of the song. And it's just this very hard-edged sound that you're not getting with any other band. And so people know House of the Rising Sun, and they know what a big deal that was, being this long song on the radio at the time. But they tend not to know the 1966 Animal sound. And this is a great field recording delineating that, essentially.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. I love the music, and I especially love the story behind another great live recording, The Doors, playing in a high school in Danbury, Connecticut in 1967.
Yes, and it meant something to me because I lived for a time in the next town over, Litchfield, Connecticut. So Danbury, Connecticut, you would know primarily, I don't know how long it's been there, because they have a mall with a carousel. And I remember back in the day, I was on the cast of Saved by the Bell there. It's like, whoa, it's later. I didn't know about The Doors playing this high school at the time, but it was a small high school, like, it was a bigger high school than Ridgefield, but it was a pretty small high school. And this was the norm, because I remember not long after seeing these photos that Linda McCartney took. She was a photographer before she married Paul McCartney, and then she was a photographer after that as well. And it was of the Yardbirds, and they were like in this assembly hall, like you remember from high school, because that was their dressing room. So it makes sense that The Doors would do this. This is what bands did. You can see, I mean, the Beatles, for instance, at one point, and they were on the verge of not international fame, but English fame. They played to an all-boys, like, eighth and ninth graders. And the kids had to be on their best behavior, and you see them in this photograph. They're sitting there. Nobody is, like, screaming. They're sitting on their hands, like, quite literally sometimes. And so you have this Doors recording from the high school. So picture this. The basketball nets are, like, tucked up into the ceiling, right? You know how that goes when it's time to bust out the dance. When it was a dance back in my time, that's when it was time to crank some, pour some sugar on me, baby. And here, though, can you imagine that? You go into this, maybe you're, like, the social studies teacher at the school, and you're like, yeah, I'll go along, and I'll just, like, chaperone this, see what happens. Not that it was just for kids. And they're playing The End. It's this Oedipal song, and Mom, I wanted to do this to you. And the father's like, whoa, son, that's not so cool. It's like, it's okay, Dad, I got something for you, too. I mean, it's really just this, like, fascinating. Again, it's like when you're out somewhere and you see some animal, and when it's not where the animal's supposed to be, it's like, hello, Mr. Fox on Newberry Street. You're up early this morning. It's like, yeah, I'm always up at this time, dude. So it's along those lines. And again, it's pretty good. It's rough and ready sound, but it's very listenable, and it's a peak door show from their breakthrough year of 67.
And I also loved it. You found, I told you, maybe my second favorite song that The Who has ever done, the only live version of The Kids Are All Right.
Now, there might be some live version. I'm not that invested in this or interested in this from, like, the 1989 reunion tour. But in terms of The Who, as I think of The Who with Keith Moon, so their performing heyday was going to be 1964 to 1976. And so this is from Sweden in the fall of 1966. 1976 really was the end of their heyday. So this is 1966. This is when they're a bubblegum group paired with a metal band, paired with an art rock sort of avant-garde combo. Songs like I'm a Boy, and like you mentioned, The Kids Are All Right, which is this drum concerto. And if you listen to the studio recording, you just hear this drummer who's the lead instrumentalist. And he drummed like no one had ever drummed. If you listen to this live version, and it's, again, perfectly listenable, he's playing the lead instrument in the song as well, and he sounds like five drummers. Really, it's amazing that he keeps the beat, plays those fills. He's doing what he's doing contrapuntally, and the band is like, okay, we'll follow you. And they have these sort of compact 3-minute narratives. That there are also these bombastic symphonies of sound, and so it's very Wagnerian, but it's very like Sugar Sugar at the same time.
I like that. That's a good analysis right there. All right, let's go from live rock and roll to one of the most iconic television shows around, one that, in the light of 21st century sensibilities, not everybody acclaims as one of the greats these days. We're talking The Andy Griffith Show.
This surprised me because I thought The Andy Griffith Show was pretty much untouchable, not because it was like this art, television art beyond everything else, but I would have thought, naively, that it wasn't something people could be upset about. You know, it's like being upset about the Twilight Zone episode that we both like so much, Walking Distance, right? It goes to this community that's very similar to the community of The Andy Griffith Show. And the knock on the show that I've been, because it's on in reruns all the time, like so much, like almost more than any other. I just encounter it a lot without trying to. I'm not someone from like, these are my glory days. This is before I was born.
Right.
I've seen it in repeats because you can't really get away from it. And I guess the idea is that everybody's white. There are towns, there still are towns, where people are predominantly one something or other, whatever it might be, in the United States of America. And it's not this conscious decision to exclude anyone else. That's just how the town has worked out for so many factors that don't indict the moral character of the residents of the town any more than their own choices in life and how they conduct themselves do. And I thought it's a show that ages well because it's very witty. Like, you see Barney Fife, you see Don Knotts there when he's on Three's Company. It's just the fool, right? You can't take it seriously. It's like, oh, you're going to poll? I got to poll. It's all just this double and ponder stuff. But he's this sort of classically neurotic character as the deputy. I feel like people could identify with him easily because he's really insecure. He's not like a buffoon. He's not an idiot. He's kind of witty. And you see someone like his friend, his cousin too, Andy, sort of taking care of this guy in terms of like, I know that he's a little frail and that he can be neurotic and he can handle this other stuff. But at the same time, I have to kind of be my brother's keeper. And you see Don Knotts' character try to do the same thing for different reasons. I find that, like, touching. It's good looking out, as they say. And that's really sort of the overarching theme of the show is good looking out. Look out for your neighbor and try to be of service to others. So that this is now bad, it's like we're going to reach a point where it's like oxygen is bad. You need to breathe the carbon dioxide, and we'll all figure it out later.
No, I agree. And you know, I look at that show, and there's a kindness to it that you didn't see on even other shows of that time period because there are no bad people on that show. There are people who make bad decisions. Otis, the town drunk. But even he's part of the family of Mayberry there, and it's a quirky cast of characters who've all got their set of foibles and inadequacies along the way, but they work because you're right. They all look out for one another.
There is that kindness, but it's not like that kindness of anything sacred. Because,
right,
like you said, they do have those shortcomings. I mean, Otis is a raging alcoholic, and he's not sort of let off the hook for that. But they also know that this man has a drinking problem, and they try to, it's almost like now with everything being closed and liquor stores remain open, and people think that's strange, but people who have a drinking problem have a real problem where if they don't have what they've been drinking, they can be in a worse kind of physical state. And I feel like the show is really ahead of its time that way. And it's not like a Seinfeld. I don't like Seinfeld because to me it's so mean-spirited. It's mean-spirited for the sake of being mean-spirited. And I think when someone comes along in life and they go at you, that gives you carte blanche to do whatever you can do back to them. I don't mean murder them, but if someone says something to you, that leaves them open to whatever you might say back to them. But no one comes at people that way in this show. They screw up all the time, and they try to help each other, and they get exasperated with each other. But there is a prevailing kindness that I think so almost everyone could benefit from viewing right now.
Though it has made me strangely happy to learn through the years that apparently Aunt B was just a huge pain in the ass to work with.
Oh, was she really? It's funny because like when you see the first series of it, and some shows are just immediately formed, right? They're like formed on arrival. We mentioned in the Twilight Zone, that episode is like the second or third episode. If you watch the first episode of Newhart, the one set in Vermont, and he is going to have in these Daughters of the Revolution to talk about the Stafford. And the show is largely fully formed. Mm-hmm. Here's it's fully formed quite early. But they hadn't figured out a lot of the dynamics in the Andy Griffith Show in the first season. You see this edge to Andy that he's not going to have later. Later, he's kind of like this Santa Claus figure. He's avuncular, I would say. Mm. And Don Knotts is not really, he doesn't have the depth yet, but I did not know that about Andy. She was one of those people who, as you'd expect, was in everything. You look up right. people like on Wikipedia, and you've seen them in so many other programs and films, and they're not even credited sometimes in so many of the films they're in. And she was just in so many different things, and she's this matronly presence. But I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to handle that information.
Well, it will take some time to process, I'm sure, but I know you're up to it. Colin, we thank you. As always, every week, a fascinating conversation. Check out Colin's work at ColinFlemingLit.com, and hopefully that Wall Street Journal op-ed works out. We'll look forward for that as well.
Yeah, we're good. We'll just start the text.
All right. Thanks, Colin. We'll talk with you next week.
All right, I'll see you later.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.